you call out Baltimore in your book, you don't mention the tax revolt that did take place in Maryland. The voters of Prince George's County in 1978, the same time the voters of San Francisco did it, capped property taxes. At that time, Prince George's had a bigger population than Montgomery County. Montgomery has never capped property taxes. It has grown more than twice as fast as Prince George's County. How does that fit into your theory?
Well, both Montgomery and Prince George's County have property tax rates far, far below Baltimore City's. We would love to have the economic performance, the job creation performance, the population growth performance that Prince George's County had in Baltimore City. So in terms of where the capital flows, my argument is capital flows where it is protected and where the rates are competitive. It's competitive in both of those counties. It's a little bit, if memory serves, the property tax rate in Montgomery County is comparable to that in Prince George's County, if not a little bit lower. And capital's flowing there. The property tax rate in the District of Columbia is lower than it is in Baltimore City, and population is growing there, and capital is flowing there. So what we have to do is just stop repelling capital with those two things. Bad cash flow. I mean, the rates hurt, but also people are very insecure about the long-term viability of those investments that they might make in the city. They're much more secure making those investments in the D.C. suburbs, in PG County and Montgomery County, and in the district itself.
What's your take on Baltimore City's proposal to sell 4 of its parking garages?
Great plan. The mayor deserves kudos for realizing we're not getting out of those assets what we could get out of those assets. If you like public ownership of these kinds of things, you have to think back to the days of high-rise public housing and think, was government really a great landlord? Was it really wise for government to get in the business of being a landlord when they were unguided by prices, they were unguided by the profit motive or a survival test and so forth? The history of public housing in the United States, I think, pretty clearly establishes that there are certain things that government does well and there are certain things that are better left to the private sector. So running a parking garage and pricing it efficiently so that the optimum number of spaces are available and so forth, that's just something that's better left to the private sector. So they'll probably be able to sell these assets and generate returns far in excess of the returns that they could generate under public administration. And then they'll use the proceeds to do things that have a higher social value in the long run. So that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. Take key infrastructure that the public sector typically administers poorly and let somebody else do it and use the resources to pursue other public goods.
Back on property taxes, during the 2011 mayor's race in Baltimore, you and others made capping property taxes an issue, and voters pretty much said, "Nah, can you do this without big voter support?"
Well, in the Democratic primary, there are 4 candidates. All 4 of them had property tax proposals as part of their platforms. The winner's property tax cut proposal was the most modest cut, but she's doing it. The second place contestant, Catherine Pugh, had essentially the tax proposal, the 1% solution that's in this book, and she got 25% of the vote. So when 100% of the votes go to people that are proposing property taxes, I'd say the public is sort of falling into line that this is a problem. The key question is, as you raised it, how do you get this done? And so in the book, the proposal is referred to as cash on delivery. Let's put a lid on taxes, but deliver it, say, 4 years from now with a charter amendment or some other constitutional guarantee that says, here's what the rate's going to be 4 years from now. That, unlike San Francisco, unlike Boston, when their statewide referenda sort of imposed budgetary discipline on them against their will, that gives us some time to plan for the day when the property tax rate in the city is competitive. And what it'll do is it'll kick off an investment wave that'll start filling our coffers and equipping us to pay for that property tax cut.
But it's not about, no one's talking about the kind of unchangeable, immutable lid on taxes that I thought you said was really important to get the investment effect you're counting on.
Well, Senator Pugh was.
Right, but
right.
I'm talking...
Everybody else is basically trying to do this on a pay-as-you-go basis. So, for example, the mayor's plan is I'm going to divert revenue from other things, the rain tax, the casino revenue, and so forth. I'm going to devote certain other sources of revenue to paying down a property tax cut. The other candidates had similar kinds of pay-as-you-go plans. My point would be that's likely to be too little, and it runs the risk that we just won't follow through on it. We'll start again. We've got a short-sightedness problem in the political sector. Once there's a new crisis, or once there's a new lawsuit about this budget reform or pension reform and so forth, we'll say, yeah, we promised to do that tax cut, but we can't actually follow through on it. We've actually got to commit to this. And if we want to call forth the kind of investment that will re-energize the city and start creating jobs rather than destroying them, we really have to reassure people that, no, this is going to happen, and it's going to be a permanent feature of Baltimore's economic landscape. If we don't do that, then the capital won't come back, and the jobs won't come back, and incomes won't grow, and we'll just be in a holding action.
So the casino opening on its own is not enough to... evoke this kind
it's
of
not, it's
response.
Not an, it's not enough to reassure until the rate comes down to a competitive level and is seen to be staying there for the long haul, then the capital reinvestment in the magnitude that we really need to see it. I mean, we've lost 43,000 private sector jobs in the city in the last decade. We need to recapitalize the city. We need to reemploy people. And the waves of investment that we really need, it's just not enough to say, well, we're cutting a few pennies off this year, and we hope to do it again next year, and so forth. We need to guarantee to people that the investment environment will be secure for decades going forward.
Okay, let me ask you about another frontier. You point out in your book that most of Baltimore's success stories, like the Inner Harbor, were created with tax breaks for developers, and you contend there should be tax breaks for everyone.
Yeah.
So now we're at a turning point where the Baltimore Development Corporation, the driver of tax cuts for developers, is about to be headed by William Cole, who, while he's been on the city council, has seemed interested in some of your ideas. Are you mm-hmm. expecting a change in strategy in Baltimore
tax
cuts?
I'm not sure
cuts?
I would say expecting, but I'm hoping. Again, I think that the last election showed that people are starting to get this, that we've been at this for decades. We've been telling ourselves that if we do this with schools, or if we do that with policing, or if we do this with Inner Harbor development, and we have special tax breaks for this key developer and so forth, that it'll turn us around. And we've had 6 decades of population loss and an uninterrupted level of job loss. So I think people are starting to say, we're going to have to do something different here. We've tried everything else, and half measures haven't been really reversing the outflows of people and capital that will, again, enable Baltimore to prosper. So I'm hopeful. You know, when I talk to development officials in the city, when I give speeches about this around town, from time to time, development people will come up to me and sort of whisper and say, so what you're saying is what we do on a couple of blocks and we go before the city council and we appeal for a special tax break or a special financing and so forth, you're saying this has to be done across the city. And they sort of nod and say, yeah, we agree, because the city's 80 square miles and we're just doing it in a few acres here and there, and it's just not enough. It's a tidal wave of disinvestment that we have to reverse.
Last question. You end the book with 10 boom commandments. I'm going to ask the classic broadcast news 10 commandments question. What are the 3 most important?
Don't steal.
Which means?
The issue that you've been asking most about, which is the property tax expropriation question. We have to reassure people that if they're going to make these long-lived investments, that the value of those investments won't be taken from them.
Number 2.
Don't lie. We need to price things properly. The most expensive thing in the world sometimes is something that you're trying to give away free. So we need honest prices with respect to a lot of the services that we provide. We need honest prices with respect to a lot of the public goods that we sometimes waste vast amounts of resources competing over. I'm talking about things like, you know, tolls getting into and out of cities. I'm talking about things like parking prices and garage prices and so forth. But I'm also talking about things like The prices that we pay for elementary services, for schools and crime and so forth. We need to price these things accurately so that people know what they're paying for and they're paying honest prices for what they're getting. I guess the third thing I'm going to summarize by simply saying we need to take account of the property rights in common areas as well as, you know, a lot of this discussion is focused on private property, our homes, our businesses, and so forth, and diminished value of that comes through taxation, say. But in a city, it's just as important how we take care of the common property that is under all of our ownership and stewardship. And so I would say that in a city as dense as Baltimore or denser, you need to be aware that civilized behavior and orderly common property is really key to how people view the city and whether they will choose to live and invest there or not. We need to really pay very close attention to how we're administering that common property. We need everybody to get involved in saying there are certain kinds of behavior that we're just not going to tolerate, and we're going to be civilized in our common property. So, for example, that's the essence of broken windows policing. You're trying to send a signal to people, as New York did so successfully starting in the 90s and reducing homicide rates and so forth, by starting small and saying we're going to address symptoms of disorder. And we're going to, for example, arrest people who are jumping over the turnstiles in the subways. And then we find out that other people who were disturbed by the signs of disorder in the common areas, they start using those common areas more often. And then you're into a virtuous cycle where there are more eyes on the street or eyes in the subway. And these places become safer, more civilized places. We need to start doing that all over Baltimore and all over a lot of cities. We need to start saying these are areas that we all own in common with each other, and we need to, some of us need to step up and say we're willing to articulate codes of civilized conduct in these areas, and we need to do some policing that will make these common areas safe for us all.
Thank you.
Thank you.